It's Wednesday, July 25th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 62 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 56 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Adam.
My name is Luke.
My name is John.
And for those of you wondering who the heck Luke is, Luke is sitting in with us as a guest host this episode. You people that use the forums would recognize Luke as iTyrant. And so he is our resident doctor here to answer all of your optometry questions. So if you call in on the Fear the Boot studio hotline, we will put you live on air and you can ask him your question.
Could you really make a ghost see twice as far with ocular implants?
Yes. Yes. Three times sometimes.
Oh my God, it's wow. True. Yeah.
Speaking of the forums, apparently in the Phil Praise episode, we credited / miscredited everyone and their mom for the flying train picture. And so we're going to set that right. Who that actually comes from is forum user Shandrun. So if you have not seen the Phil flying train picture, go check it out on our forums at feartheboot.com.
Sorry about that, bud.
And if you have seen it, you need to credit Shandrun, not Santa Claus or whoever it is that we
credited Flaming Penguins.
We went off the rails on that crazy train.
I was a little hurt that I wasn't credited by that. I think I was the only one on the forums who wasn't.
Well, we just couldn't see any reason to do that.
I don't know where you're going with that.
This is going to be terrible. It
should be clear as glass, but don't worry.
As pupil.
Yes, you'll be my pun pupil, and as long as we have contact with each other. So, the next thing up real quick, second last item of business here, is Angst Boy, who was one of the winners of our Nazi Zombie Bugbear contest, has foregone a traditional prize in favor of a non-traditional prize. He wanted me to mention a website of his, which I will also link in the show notes, and the web address is www.daddymonkeylives.com. It's daddy like as in father, monkey like as in the simian, lives as in not dead yet, .com.
With a URL like that, you have to tell me what this is about.
Basically what they do is they do reviews of like movies, music, games, books, stuff like that. And they also occasionally just write columns about whatever's on their mind. It's a kind of general culture site. I checked it out today. It actually looks pretty cool. So if you have never heard of this site, as I had not until today, then check out daddymonkeylives.com. And we will put that in the show notes as well. And Angst Boy, thank you for your entry. And we're willing to work with you guys on these non-traditional prizes as long as you don't have something like
weird.
Yeah, weird or obscene that you want us to do, which I'd give an example of, but we're not sufficiently rated for. But
Nazi zombie bugbear shot with my PPC.
I didn't realize letter C was coming there, and that made for completely different. last thing real quick is the Ennies are still up. If you have not voted yet, or if there's a computer you've not voted from yet because it's by IP.
I will tell you guys this. I am a consultant and have access to many client servers. I have voted from all of them.
I'll tell you right now, this is what happens when you unleash nerds upon a voting contest.
Oh my God, it's terrible.
My brother, of course, who works for Microsoft, says that they have a ton of internal IPs. He cycled through all of them. Every single one of them has been used for an abuse vote. So,
Danny gets DQ'd.
This is exactly what happens when you unleash this many nerds upon a voting contest. But if you're an honest person who hasn't voted for us yet, please go out to ennieawards.com. That's ENNIE awards, plural.com. And be sure to vote for us under your favorite podcast, Vidcast, and fill out the rest of it however you like. You know, it's up to you. We don't really.
We can be your somewhere. Favorite yeah, in-game art as well.
Bit, actually, what are you going to do? Putting out a bunch of free stuff last year.
Yeah, I heard Battletech is back in there, and that pleases me. I'm upset Fear the Boot is not under best cover art, nor are we under best rule system. But
next year.
That's next year. They said something about we actually have to be on the cover of a book tender for the best cover art. So,
well, we had that blue boot very long ago, and that was dubious. That got us knocked out.
Yeah, dubious
that thing
is
was
not
kind of ugly.
Yeah, dubious and ugly are not the words I'd use to describe it. Let's just say it'd be something and not in an 1890s sort of way. So,
no one got that.
No,
I got it,
especially not me.
Okay, well, I'll explain after the show.
Okay.
All right, first real subject for today, determining rank in an RPG. There are a ton of...
I'm captain.
No. Oh my God, I called it on the way home. You have to see the source book.
No.
There are a ton of RPGs out there where you have to have rank for some reason. Star Trek, maybe Star Wars. We've got some homebrews, BattleTech, where somebody has to be in charge, and somebody...
This selection process is painful.
Because
just take the feat. You take the feat, you're the captain, done. Easy.
There's a feat?
Oh, yeah, there's a feat. There's a feat for everything.
There's not a feat in BattleTech.
Well, there's an edge. I'm thinking Savage Worlds. Sorry.
All right.
All right.
Nobody plays it.
Well, see, that's the confusion here, is Luke, unlike us...
Yeah, you're playing a game that was made sometime this century. Yeah.
You're playing a game that was not carved upon stone tablets in Mesopotamia.
That's true.
And therefore, we are not aware of this.
Given to man at Mount Sinai.
Yes.
Actually, Luke, what are some of the games that you're up on, just to give people a little bit of a gaming resume on you?
I'm all over the place. That's my problem. For a while, I was a gaming whore, and I bought everything that came out for a good 5 or 6 years, and that's what you get when you subscribe.
Wow, the market must really like you.
They do, and my wallet and my student loans did not.
All right, well, what did you actually play? This is like a Jelly of the Month club. I mean, you throw 11 of them away.
Yeah,
so.
That's which is true. The big ones, you know, I'm a huge Savage Worlds fan. Anything Pinnacle puts out, Deadlands being my favorite setting, my favorite system, it's fantastic. But
okay,
I played D20, World of Darkness, Warhammer Fantasy.
Which version of World of Darkness?
Both, actually, the old
one
and the new.
All right,
both, mainly Vampire in that. Played Palladium. I mean, you name it. Even some of the indie games, I've probably played at least
really?
One session.
Have you played Justifiers?
I've not played Justifiers.
That's the one indie game I was a huge fan of, and it came and went very quickly. And outside of Chad, who played it with me, I have yet to meet anyone else who played it. Unfortunately.
You lone wolfed it?
No. It was me, Chad, and another guy who unfortunately just died of a heart attack at the ripe old age of 32. So, folks, please do take care of yourselves, but having thrown that killjoy in there.
Join the daily play.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Nonetheless, I have yet to meet anyone else that's played the game, and the game was fun, both in this world and the next. So, all right, getting back to determining rank in a game, when you've got a group of temperamental people in front of you, what process do you guys use in going about determining who's going to be in charge? And Luke, I'm going to pick on you first.
Ooh.
You know, usually it's just player agreement and the GM. You've got to sit down and agree if somebody's going to be in charge or if they're just going to be an NPC that the GM takes control of, because nobody wants to be that bad
guy. That's one of the three I could come up with.
All right, hold on. Let's player agreement.
That one stinks.
How do you even arrive at that? This is like world peace. I understand the concept, but how do you get from here to
there?
You
know, I actually had a gamer in just a while ago where they were a pirate crew and somebody had to take control of the ship, and everybody agreed, you'll be a good captain because I want to be the cook and I want to be something else. I think the key is you've got to make the other roles be viable, something fun, something that you can have people do that doesn't involve giving orders, that involves something that can contribute.
That involves peeling potatoes,
you know, cutting up pufferfish, what have you.
I got to say that's an approach that I have never yet taken in a game.
I've seen it done.
Is trying to sell the other positions as a way of drawing attention away from the guy who's in charge.
Oh, yeah, I've never seen that done. So I guess that's number four.
Yeah. But trying to play up that all the lackey positions are somehow a lot more fun to play.
You can't have a ship without a swab, Dan.
Well,
you need
a
swab.
Well, right, but how would you sell that to somebody?
I'm glad I'm a beta. Those alphas work too hard.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean,
thank you. You're welcome.
Let's say we're playing a game, I don't know, you're talking... Savage Worlds, where we're some kind of a militia and there's got to be a lieutenant and a bunch of privates.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sell up those private positions to
latrine duty? It's awesome.
You get to do what he says.
See, I'm gonna approach this from a different way than you guys probably are used to, because in Savage Worlds, which is my primary system, you can run a ridiculous amount of people on the battle mat at once if you use a battle mat, for instance. So
okay,
if you have somebody running a private, generally, I'm going to give him 4 or 5 guys. If we get into combat, he can control with them. So he's got himself, and he's got some people.
I see. All right.
So it makes it a little more viable.
All right, well, let's say you're not playing Savage Worlds.
So give them all the privates they want.
You're screwed. You don't want to do that unless you're playing Savage Worlds.
Hey, don't touch my privates.
You have my role to hit my privates.
I've gotten away with this sometimes in games like D&D by playing up other positions, in that I promise some things later in the plot that I say that... No, I'm serious, and I deliver on this,
okay,
too.
Okay, all right, well, as long as you deliver.
That I'll say, you know, like, all right, the captain of the guard obviously has the benefit of being the captain of the guard, but if you play the guy who's kind of over here, that he's going to have a huge role later in the game, because, let's be honest, there's two attractions to being the guy in charge. One is the obvious one of you get to boss people around and not be bossed around. The second is the fact that you get to be the center of attention so much. And you can't take away perk number one, but you can take away perk number two. I guess not maybe take it away, but you can
you
use
can
that.
Diminish the appeal.
You can use that as a selling point to say, look, the guy who's the private over here, I'm going to develop a huge plot point that's going to center around his family or his whatever, that where the captain suddenly is going to be a little bit in the background, and that might play up the appeal of that role some.
You've also got the niches that are involved. If you make the private say he's the stealthy guy, there's a lot of stuff he's going to be able to do that say the captain wouldn't be able to, or the guy with contacts in the local, you know, the towns and whatnot. You can always
so specification.
Go to
you've always got that outside guy who isn't really in the hierarchy that, you know, does his own little thing.
Honestly, the way that I typically decide is by group politics. That I look at my group and I know there are certain people that are willing to take orders, and there are certain people that are very, very touchy, that they're very, I don't want to quite say...
Buck the administration?
Yeah, that they hate authority, they hate people telling them what to do, and there's other
people... I hate the man, and now you're the man.
Yeah, exactly. And so a lot of times, I decide based on group politics that...
So this is the second of my list of three where you just assign it.
Yeah, and I assign it typically, like I said, based on that politic of, well... Like I said, I know so-and-so is going to be okay with being bossed around and so-and-so is not.
But does that not lead to the same roles every time in
it
every
does.
Game?
It does.
It does, but you know what? You and I have seen it run poorly.
Yeah,
where the
have.
Wrong person gets assigned the role.
Yeah, exactly. That's the third option that I came up with, following your list of three, I guess. I don't know if this is your say number three or
not.
Is you make the ironic choice. That you intentionally pick the guy who's quiet and sucks in the leadership positions.
We've seen that done a lot.
Or you pick the poor girl who's never RP'd before in her life.
Yeah, that has been done too.
And you make her... And honestly, that's funny for a game.
We've had that change in game. I've been the ironic leader that's been deposed. It was a fun game session too.
But do games like that last, really?
Not really.
Because... Playing to the politics thing, it's like saying, okay, yeah, it's a formula and you get the same thing every game, but you know what? It works and the games last.
Whereas, well, it strikes me as you can have it one of two ways. You can either have the social structure be the constant, or the entire plot is about the social structure changing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can pick one or the other, and if you've already got a plot in mind...
Yeah, I think the worst side of this, or at least the worst side of this, is that when you have two guys who want to be in command and are fighting over it more so than the one guy who doesn't want it.
This is my third one, which is the group vote. The group vote is dangerous.
We've had that. We used to do that with Battletech. We used to have where we would start off with nominations and you could not nominate yourself. And then based on that, you would have to rank and do voting and you could not vote for yourself. And then based on that, we would elect the leader. And we did that.
Elections can get ugly.
We did that for several games and it worked out all right. I don't remember any real problems with it. It may not work in every group just because once again, you may get that one guy who just can't stand being told what to do by so-and-so for whatever interpersonal.
I've gamed with Phil. I know.
Actually, it's not Phil I was referring to, but
I know, but
you've never gamed with Phil.
No, I have. It was once. I GM'd a Battletech game for once.
Okay, one game doesn't count as gaming with
Phil.
I
realize that.
Were there any explosions?
Not real ones, no.
You didn't game with Phil.
See, I've run Phil twice now. No explosions yet. A lot of shooting, though.
And he comes back. Oh, shooting, all right.
The thing is, I keep promising him each time that, Phil, I know you went like combat that last Fear the Boot episode, really let me know what you like. It was kind of a how to GM Phil. So I'm going to have explosions.
Right.
Next game.
Right, exactly. And just like with Garfield, tomorrow never comes.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So
no lasagna for Phil.
It's always next game. And guess what? This game is not next game, ever. One other trick that I have found that helps out a little bit, and this is only necessary in certain games. The big one that I had to use this in was Star Trek. Because in Star Trek, the original series, there's always a question of why is the captain of the ship beaming down to the planet?
Because he's Kirk.
Because
he's James Tiberius Kirk.
You know,
if your middle name was Tiberius, you'd beam all
over
the
green women.
Yeah, that's where the ladies are at. He's not going to stand.
The guy that commands an aircraft carrier does not hop in a plane and fly a mission. You know,
if he was James Tiberius Kirk, he would.
But part of the thing
is, Bill Pullman was the president. And
all the World War II video games I've played disagree with your statement.
But
and I've played a lot.
Winston Churchill flying.
Yes.
Bowler hat and cigars.
Churchill actually did. He never piloted a Supermarine Spitfire, but he did gun one.
Of course he did. There were Nazi zombie bugbears to kill.
When they were designing the plane, they let him sit in there and pull the trigger and fire its machine guns and cannons, and they had to stop him because he nearly blew through the back baffle.
That's awesome.
But
he's Churchill. You're going to stop him from blowing up anything within range? No.
Churchill's
Yeah, I mean, when a mustache, a top hat, and a cigar are all coming at you at once, I mean, what the hell can you possibly do?
What threat are bullets?
Exactly. But the other, what we did in Star Trek was we did not want to NPC the captain, because part of the attraction of Star Trek, of course, is captaining the ship. And so we let the captain be a PC. But one of the things we did that did a double thing for us, one, it allowed us to leave someone behind on the ship when the party beamed down. And secondly, it also helped defray the command issues a little bit, was the second in command was an NPC. So that way you have one person who's the boss, but at least among the remaining people, they are all equals. That they are all, you know, lieutenant commanders or whatever, and are basically on equal footing. The second in command's an NPC, so you don't have quite so much of a defined pecking order. But like I said, it was also a nuance of Star Trek because we had to leave someone on the ship.
And translation, I wanted to play Riker.
No, he said beard. TOS.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no. I always run movie era, like movie 1-6 era when I play Star Trek, like Wrath of Khan sort of
thing. See, the only problem with that is that the captain then becomes too removed from the party, because then there's that whole like social strata in between the two. Like, we're all down here, and then there's the NPC, and then there's the captain.
Well, and I think some of this also is there's got to be a player agreement that you can't put an asshole in charge. And I'm just I'm just going to spell it out as plainly as I can, that if you've got the guy who's going to be an elitist, or who's going to be bossy, you can't put him in command because he's just going to piss everyone off.
This is the biggest problem with the three methods of picking these guys.
Yeah, and the one of the things that we found in a lot of games is that we tend to run it where you have that military unit where there's one guy who's technically in charge. He's the boss. He's the tie-breaking vote. But you guys know each other for years and you get along great. It's very informal. You know, it's not like you're just his bootlicks. You know, this guy, he's not going to boss you around. He's interested in your input. He respects your knowledge. And, you know, I don't know any better way to put it than say, if there's a guy in the group who can't taking orders, but's also a jerk, you're destroying your game by putting him in charge. Yes. It's better just to let him be in a submissive role. And if he leaves, let him go.
Or better yet, John brought up a good point earlier with the you know, the loyal outsider who's not really in the command structure.
Yeah,
look to Mel Gibson for the wisdom here. You know, Braveheart, Patriot, you've got the French guy, you've got the Irish guy who's outside, who's kind of cool.
You have your Stephen Maturin, you I have see. Your yes. Agent Kira.
He doesn't have to take orders. He's there because he wants to be, because this island's across the way and he doesn't want your crap spilling over on it.
I see. I can see where you're coming from. In a recent homebrew sci-fi, we had a guy playing an alien attaché to a group of human soldiers. And he carried some kind of a fairly high rank, but wasn't technically part of, you know, he was an attaché. He wasn't technically part of the actual rank structure, but nonetheless carried some like field rank that gave him that authority. But yeah, I can see what you're saying, because that does detach him a little bit to where he's not so bossy and he's not so pushy, because to a certain degree, if he's role-playing it and he's not just spilling over ICOOC issues into being bossy, if he's role-playing it, there is a certain amount of detachment of where in the end he doesn't care who wins this war. I mean, he may have a favored party, but it's not like his home gets burned if the evil aliens win.
This guy sounds like a douchebag.
Yeah, he does.
Why do we want him on our side?
Because he has a phaser.
Not a Braveheart. Wrong movie. Yeah.
Oh.
Alrighty. Little things game masters can do to ruin a game. Single unintentional acts that can destroy a game. This is like when you're on your first blind date with a girl and you accidentally fart in the middle of dinner. All right. This is a single little unintentional thing that can just completely wreck a game. And we came up with
these.
We came up with a couple of these. Luke, do you want to fire out your one of first comes to mind?
Oh, yeah. This is a horror story from my past.
And a horror story or horror story?
Both, kind of. Okay. Because it all comes down to the same thing. I named a character off a random name generator I had made up earlier, just all the syllables off the cuff, didn't sound it out beforehand, and spewed out Lickiata. It was Princess Lickiata. And that was the start of the worst game session I have ever ran. It ended in Rainbow Bridges. I'll say that and that alone.
Well, Mario Kart ended in Rainbow Bridges, and I loved that, so I'm not going to knock that down.
You need to talk to my old group.
And supposedly, things over. Pet's lifespan is in a Rainbow Bridge as well, but I don't think in this way.
No.
Yeah, single names that can ruin them, and there's a couple ways you can get that. One is the names sound funny.
Yes.
A la
Licciata. I get past that.
Or the second is the names are so complex and so weird, you can't remember them. There was a game we were playing, I think this was Ravenloft, and I believe the NPC's name, and he is a world NPC, was like Bucaccio or something like that.
Sounds
and
like Bucaccio.
Actually, the Italian Bucaccio.
This was years ago. The word Bucacci had not entered the English language yet. Instead of Bucaccio, we were calling him Effing Pistachio, except Effing was, you know,
right,
set out in a rating not safe way. And because the name was too weird, we couldn't, it's not like his name was like Bob or something that we could remember.
You've got to remember that your players are going to resort to the closest sounding name they can hit without thinking about it. They won't remember the complex stuff. They're just going to remember the basic syllables, and it's going to be nothing like you intended.
Sometimes you can't even do anything about this. Like, you'll have a perfectly acceptable, simple name. It's just that they'll come up with a funnier nickname, and then you're screwed. Like,
sometimes you won't even name the NPC, and then they'll name him, and then it'll stick.
The robot who happens to be a boxer. He's Boxbot.
Yes.
No one takes him seriously for the rest of the campaign.
Yes, and this happened in a recent game.
Boxbot.
We had a robot who was just like you'd have a boxing video game. This was set in a sci-fi game. You had a boxing robot where basically you would give him a difficulty level and he would simulate boxing with you. And that's all he became known as for the rest of the campaign.
And then his head sprung up at the end when he lost.
That's exactly what
the commercial ended. Oh, that's where I went to.
Was Boxbot.
Wow. There's also the corollary to that, which is too many names. If you run the Silmarillion, the role-playing game, they're going to get just as lost as they would if they tried to read the book.
They can't remember any of them. And that's where, and this could happen in the single names as well as the too many names. This is something Seamus Young brings out in DM of the Rings. They fall down to stereotypes. That the guy that you gave this really cool grandiose name to becomes the tag-along wizard.
Yeah.
Or the guy with the big beard or Fatso or whatever.
Or another NPC who has a similar sounding name but is not the same person.
Yeah, exactly.
We've defeated Saruman. The quest is over.
We've defeated Saruman. Therefore, his eye should disappear from the top of the
Minas
tower.
Morgul will crumble. We can just keep the ring now.
Slips. Freudian slips. I have destroyed so many games with these slips where I reveal things I didn't intend to reveal. There was a Star Trek game I was running where there were these little electrical or like electronic nodes that were ringing this mountain. And they kept saying, okay, we're going to try this. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And I kept saying, you know, okay, well, as you look at the node, as you do this. And then I actually slipped and said, all right, as you walk around, you see another one of the sensors sitting right there. And also, there's like, oh, they're sensors, are they? And I'm like, damn it. There just went like 30 minutes worth of plot material. I guess the other type of slip you could do is a funny kind of Freudian slip where you say something.
Yeah, you've got the total and complete concentration of everybody in the group, and then you slip and say nipple.
Yeah, exactly. You say something, you just slur words together or say something obscene.
Meanwhile, it becomes penis and concentration is gone.
Yeah.
And then the Monty Python.
Which I am at fault for.
No,
on this.
We don't tolerate those.
I'm at fault for on this very podcast. Forget gaming. Jim and Buffalo called me out on this, that there was an episode, I guess we did two or three ago, where I meant to say throw in the towel as in to quit. And I said throw in the hat, which means to join into. And so I used the wrong phrase there and completely changed the meaning of a sentence.
And wow, you completely derailed the entire podcast with it.
I did. I'm sure there's tons of little GM mistakes we could come up with or little ways GMs can throw a game. Last one that comes to mind, though, that I want to bring up now is rolling too many dice.
Click, 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 click.
Well, what I mean is, like, there's a plot point you need to go a certain way, yet rather than just letting it go that way.
Well, it has to happen.
Or rolling behind the screen and then giving the result no matter what.
Yeah, for some foolish reason, you feel compelled to roll anyway, and then it doesn't turn out the way you hoped. But let me change that. It doesn't turn out the way you needed for your plot for some reason.
For the one direction you have the story to go.
Yeah, exactly. and you really aren't ready to roll with the outcome of that die, and yet you rolled it anyway, rather than just saying, okay, here's what happens. And perfect.
I approve.
All right. Gen Con is, of course, coming up here in just a matter of weeks.
Oh, I am excited.
I'm already pre-gaming.
And I would like to remind everyone of a couple things. First of all, that on Saturday from 7 to 9, there will be a podcast reception. We'd love to meet you guys. The event apparently does require a sign-up, but it has something like 300 slots open. And I'll tell you right now, I personally won't kick you out if you show up without signing up. So I don't know if the sign-up even matters. But there is a sign up for that. It's crazy.
You guys are so going to get blacklisted for saying that.
Yeah.
You're out.
Well,
we can make Fear the Boot Nation down the street at the
Smoky Bones.
Yeah, exactly.
We can crash Smoky Bones and turn it into a Fear the Boot place. I will also be on two panels. One is promoting your podcast Saturday at 11 a.m.
Nah, you don't need to do that.
And the other is going to be the future of podcasting Saturday at 5 p.m.
So podcasting's not going
to be. Podcasting has no future.
If you want to see Fear the Boot in action, Saturday is your day, 11, 5, and then 7 to 9. Also, throughout the weekend, we are putting on three Skies of Glass demo games. If you want to know more about those, you need to contact OboCop, that's O-B-O-E space cop, on our forum, which is Chris Hussey, and he will help you get signed up for those and set up for those. I'm not clear on the status of exactly whether they're official or non-official events, and I think we've fallen somewhere in a gray area. So
last he makes I checked, Meatloaf references. He's cool in my book.
Last I checked, they were not officially approved by Gen Con because we submitted them after the registration date had closed. However, they may be on the on-site book there.
Right.
So we're still going to have them. It's just that they're not in that official pre-con registration.
So
thing.
If you want to try Skies of Glass in action, then get in touch with Chris Hussey and or get in touch with me, and I will forward your message to him, one of the two, and he can help you guys get signed up for that.
I think
that.
There's only 18 slots total.
Now, before Gen Con happens, the very first weekend of August is our local St. Louis convention, Archon, where we have a ton of stuff going on. We have panels and interviews and workshops, and I'm basically
drinking.
We are
going to
be working that con from.
You were going to say we are going to be wasted
from start to finish. But here is the best part: we found out about a panel we were not invited to that we are so going to crash.
I'm there,
Adam. You've got to say this.
I don't know what the name of the actual panel is.
I don't either.
Who does?
Who cares?
What's
it's a furry
point?
Panel.
It's, what is it rated, Adam?
It's rated R.
It is an R rated.
That means R for fantastic.
That's right. R fantastic.
Fantastic.
On a scale of one to awesome.
It is
awesome. It's weird.
It is an R rated adults only furry panel that we are so going to crash, probably with a video camera.
Or two. It's
or
gonna
two. And we are probably, I hope, going to have some fantastic con reporting. We are going to put a lot of stuff from Archon on Archon's actual feed, but we will probably have at least one compiled like bonus episode from Archon that we will put on our Fear the Boot feed.
We'll have a special Fear the Boot episode. Why did you invite yourself to my subculture? Starring the furries.
I may try and edit us together another Archon
another,
video.
Yeah. Excellent. There's going to be at
like
least...
the ASIN video?
Yeah.
Superb.
There's going to be at least one best of episode to come out of this whole thing.
I think so, too.
For those who haven't been to Archon, picture a gigantic cake you're walking into.
Are you coming to Archon?
I don't think I'm coming to Archon.
Oh, why? Come on. Why not, man?
If I own my own business. If I'm not there, the business don't make no money.
Going on Saturday.
No, I work on Saturday.
No.
Saturday night.
That's going illegal. On Saturday night for Sunday, for the Saturday night party.
Friday
you don't
night.
Work on Sundays, do you?
Wait, I don't work on Sundays.
Well, what's your business? I mean, surely you make like Friday night and Saturday night.
I could get married Friday night.
All right. See, Adam and I, well, actually all of us at this one will be wielding an artifact of great power.
Called the press pass.
Called the press pass. At Gen Con, they only give us two, so it'll be Adam and I. But
what?
Archon.
You guys are bastards.
Hey, jerk. I'm sorry.
Keep talking.
Do you guys go by age? Is that why you don't get one?
I don't know. There's some manner of illegal discrimination going on here, and I'm going to find it.
There was.
Actually,
we didn't even know if John was going.
Actually,
at that point.
It's we have a thing against Italians.
That's very true.
They asked us. I shouldn't say that. So I won't. insert funny joke right there. It's not appropriate for all ages. But anyway, they'd only give us two, much to our annoyance. So we had to pick. And so at Archon, though, we will all have press passes, which we will abuse greatly upon the beer line. So if you are in the St. Louis area or willing to stop by the St. Louis area that first weekend of August, we'd love to see you. If you're going to be at Gen Con, tons of stuff going on. We'd love to see you there. All right. The real media advice topic for today.
Oh, are we actually talking about something?
We are. We've been talking about lots of somethings, just not.
I meant something else.
Direct and purposeful somethings.
All right.
So now we're talking about direct and purposeful something, which is player-driven games.
I don't like them.
Now, we have mentioned. Wouldn't.
I know.
Like gas, we have mentioned these in passing. We have talked about, for example, during the man versus environment or the man versus self or in some of our other episodes, we have talked about in passing the player-driven games where a GM creates sort of a sandbox or situation, but really doesn't have a plot. He just kind of lets the players drive it along. But up until this point, we haven't been able to really give a whole lot of insight because none of us within the normal Fear the Boot circle typically run those kinds of games. But sitting here today,
we have the abnormal Fear the Boot.
Is a man yes. Is a man who is so insane that this is his normative game, and we want to pick his twisted mind for insight on how this goes down. So Luke, I don't even know where to begin. If you were to teach someone how to run this kind of game or give advice, where would you even start?
It all has to start at the GM. This is a GM. It's player-driven, but the GM has to be completely on his toes.
All right. Now, see, this is already different than I would have given it because I would have said it starts with the players.
This is totally not where I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we're going to get to the point where we're like, well, the characters decide what they want to do, but the GM has already got it prepared. Go ahead.
All right. Loop fire.
In a way.
All right. Describe this to me.
This already surprises me. How do you go on?
Well, I mean, you've got to get player approval for your setting. You know, guys, here's what I'd like to do. What do you think about that? The usual agreement. And then once you have that, the GM has to be completely.
How would you phrase
honest.
That? Let's say you're approaching me for this. What kind of thing?
Look, I want to run a game that's high on intrigue, high on plot, high on depth, and something where even the GM gets to be surprised. He doesn't know the story completely. He has to be on his toes. He is doing a dance just like the players and reacting to everything as it goes. It's a much more satisfying game.
And it's a much better sales pitch than I've not bothered to write anything.
Exactly.
Perfect.
But the problem is you do have to write, and you have to write a lot. Because, for example, I've done this successfully, and I've done this terribly. Recently, terribly, actually. The successful one, I put a lot of work into. It was a vampire game, and I built up the city. I knew every major NPC, all the organizations, in detail, their motivations, their history, and that's what you have to go on because that's what the players are going to, the mess they're going to get into. Once they start doing stuff, once the player, you give them a few hooks, you see what they bite on, and then you think, okay, the bigwigs hear about this, or somebody up the chain. How are they going to react given their resources, their history, and what the PCs have done?
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but you could say that you start out by building every what?
Everything. That's the problem.
Instead of building plot, you write setting.
You write a huge setting, and you have to know it intimately.
And it strikes me, like, unlike typical RPGs, because in a typical RPG, let's just say that you have to do, before the first game, I don't know, 10 man hours of work. Because you've got to write the plot, write a little bit of setting, come up with some structure for the party. And then before each subsequent game, you have to do maybe 2 or 3 hours of work to write the plot. It sounds to me like with this kind of gaming, you do like 100 man hours of work before the first game, and then you're basically done for every game thereafter.
Pretty much, as long as you keep up and know your NPCs and who they're going to be dealing with, you can pretty much roll with anything. The part the PCs have to play is they need to have very clearly defined goals, and they need to tell you about them, whether they want to work together, whether they don't want to. I mean, that's part of the game you want to run. You know, how do you want to do it? But they have to let you know because you have to at least know kind of what to expect. And if they don't have those goals, if they're just kind of waiting for adventure to happen to them, this isn't the kind of game for those players.
Have you ever bitten off too much doing this?
Funny you should mention that. In my most recent game, I decided instead of trying the traditional, let's run some adventures game in this high action setting I've created, I decided, that sandbox game I ran really went well.
Right.
Let's try it on a huge scale. So instead of doing just a city, I had an entire world at my fingertips, and the PCs had an airship, so they could go anywhere and do anything, and what started out being, this is going to be awesome, became, wow, They don't have clearly defined goals, and it's because I didn't. The setting is so vague because it's so vast that it's right. My fault.
Rule number one of giving them an airship: give them one clear tile they can land on.
The key with these player-driven games is don't bite off more than you can chew. Start with a city. I'm planning on running a game sometime in the future that it's a fantasy game set in a city where the players interact, build up noble houses, guilds, what have you, and do something that usually.
Did you just say the players in Iraq?
Yeah, the player, at Ziggurat Con.
Okay.
I've been in contact. I have big plans because this is the good thing about this game is, like I said, it's really satisfying as a GM because you actually become partly a player. You don't know everything that's going to happen, and you're constantly surprised, but if you're prepared enough, you can roll with it.
I've even done this, even in typical RPGs, not player-driven RPGs, I've bitten off far too much, which is why I have stopped to a large degree saying that next week we're going to start playing a brand new homebrew, because that means I have to finish the homebrew by next week. And I started, it's like, you know what, I'm going to develop something over years of time just as a back hobby, and once it's developed enough, then we will play it. And I can imagine this problem only being magnified by a player-driven game, because of the fact that, at least in my style of gaming, I don't railroad. But nonetheless, I do have some idea of where this is headed, and assuming we've done our group template right and blah, 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 I know that my players are generally going to play along. But here, and one of the questions I want to ask, because this is one of the things that scares the crap out of me with a player-driven game, you develop the heck out of that one city. What do you do when they leave?
And that is where you have to have an agreement beforehand to say, guys, this is a city we're playing in. Yeah. There's no world beyond this as far as you're concerned. If you have phone calls, internet access, that kind of thing. But in Vampire, that's pretty easy because once they have their power base, they're kind of stable.
Right.
But in games, other game settings, if you don't have an agreement with the players, well, let's not move on because I've developed while it's working to this. And if you leave it, you're going to be in, roll a D10, a forest.
Yeah. You guys want to leave the city D10. And you come across another Mako reactor. You have to blow it up.
So you have a gentleman's nod.
Yeah, you have to work together a lot more on this to get that kind of level of play.
All right, so you've approached me with your sales pitch. Mm-hmm. I've agreed to this. I'm not a jackass, so I've created a player who's going to stay in the city.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we sit down for the first session. How is this going to go down? How are you going to implement all of this?
See, the first session is more of a traditional one. You kind of set the tone. You throw out a bunch of hooks. If you've known your setting, you know what's going on in the city, and you let the PCs get the hints and see what they bite on. So even if you have to kind of lead them and do a typical adventure to start out with, usually you can work in enough extra hooks and hints at greater things that you're going to, especially if you know what the players want, you're going to entice them to follow a certain path, to meet their goal. And you basically can give them routes to do that.
So you're saying you do write some plot. That it's not like you just create the setting and set them loose. So you do have some potential plots.
You have
out there.
To have some plots, especially early on. Later, the plots will generate themselves. But at least initially, you have to have, a handful of plots to see exactly what they're going to be interested
in. One of my previous styles of writing a game, which actually still works for some games, is that I would write a main plot, which in your case, I guess for a player-driven game, you may not have. Mm-hmm. But then I would also write a series of additional subplots. That if the game is slowing down, or they're in a city and nothing's happening, or they're off the track and confused, here are these subplots written down, maybe one paragraph I've written down somewhere that I can yank out at random to get things going in or to get the players back on track. Mm-hmm. Do you do things like that? Do you have at your fingertips this little flip book of possible plots, just if like...
Well, I believe it was Raymond Chandler who said, if the action slows down, just somebody fires a gun into the room and it all starts back up again. So, you've got to have something to fall back on those days where the players just aren't into it or they're a little slow. You got to have something to get things going. But the key is to make sure that's always in the shadow of what the players want to do.
Right.
What I did a lot was I basically had a traditional story arc, but instead of it being, there's a big bad guy we have to go defeat, it's this whole threat is happening to a city or a country, and you're part of this country. How are you going to deal with it when the famine hits, when the war comes around, when Johnny the Lich pops up in the middle of your city and blights it?
I'm everywhere.
I say, seriously, that's something else you've got to do, is that when you are writing these plot lines, they always have to involve the players. That if you have a famine, yet they have tons of food, they're probably just going to ignore that.
But that's a plot in itself. They have the food. If other people know that,
They may come and get it.
Maybe the cute little starving kids are just scenery. Famine is the rioting in the streets over the bread shipment when people are killing each other.
Well, maybe that's
Let me toss in some weight on this
flavor?
Issue.
You want some add some flavor to the mix?
I'll toss in some flavor. All right. The Hispanic flavor.
I'm going to give you a funky baseline for this. All right.
I got my hydraulics.
So it seems to me that while this is still a character-driven plot, the GM still has to write the plot and is still rolling the plot with the characters. Only the difference is that the plot isn't as, I want to say, predetermined, and the GM doesn't have a direction in which he's pushing people.
I think that's actually right on the money.
Okay, you know, so it isn't a total character-driven
No, I don't think that's... I'm sure it's somebody in the small game industry will now go write the game where that's possible, but I really don't think it's possible for a GM to be completely hands-off, because he's got to drive something. He's got to give the players something, because they are not always going to be proactive.
Yeah. No matter what your players, you will hit that moment at some point in a campaign, and probably at least once a session.
Where Johnny G's narcolepsy takes over. Yes. And he's sleeping on the couch.
I'm sleeping on the couch. Adam and Dan are staring at you, and they're waiting to be fed. And the GM has to be able to move in that situation.
See, and the key that ties all this together is knowing the players' goals. If you know what they want to accomplish in, you know, short term, long term, you're going to be able to have a much better idea of how to react and what they're going to enjoy. And if you give them what they're going to enjoy or entice them with that, they're going to bite. They're going to follow. Uh-oh. And they're going to make it a better game.
Somebody's been GMing for Phil, I see.
Hold on. That's going to be our closing. That's how we're going to go out with a bang here, is with Phil. So before we get to Phil, as someone who has experienced GMing these player-driven games on a regular basis, I've dabbled in them. Mm-hmm. What do you think are the major pitfalls of a player-driven game, the major potential problem areas, and how have you gone about addressing them over the years or keeping them from happening?
You son of a bitch, I was going to ask that.
I didn't say you son of a bitch.
No cussing. Why'd you be so mean? Why do you have to use the curse words?
So pitfalls.
It's because we're both Greek.
The number one pitfall has already been covered, and that is don't bite off more than you can chew. You've got to know your setting and be ready to, you know, react to every NPC. So keep it small to start out with. Don't go making an entire world like I did, even if you have experience, because it's going to be a bad idea and it's going to fall apart in the long run.
Right.
The other big one is that GM burnout's number one, because there is a lot of work that goes into this, and if you're not committed to the actual game and the players don't bite, it's going to fall apart right away, too. You've got to have a GM who's willing to stick it out and to invest in a setting. Now, I'm a world creator. That's one of the things I love about RPGs. I create settings left and right, good, bad, ugly, so I love doing this. But
that was just Arizona.
If you don't love making settings and getting your hands dirty, thinking about how all these pieces interact, and if you just want to deal with stories instead of stories that come and are birthed from settings, you're not going to enjoy the style of gaming.
Now, because of the fact that the plot is no longer your major shepherd, have you found that you have more problems with group problems, intra-group problems, where the players are perhaps fighting to a point that's disrupting the game, or they have gone so far off the beaten path that you can't even deal with it anymore? Since you no longer have them saving the maiden, they're just kind of doing whatever they want.
In a way, though, that's kind of the goal. You know, if you have a maiden in there to save, then and you want them to do it, that's great. But if they're doing their own things in the setting, as long as they're doing something and interacting and following what their character would do, you've reached what you wanted to get.
So the goal here is chaos.
Yeah, it's actually kind of a controlled chaos.
I wouldn't say that it was necessarily chaos, but it's a degree of control that we're unaccustomed to. Like, when I think of a role-playing game, I always think that the GM should be in total control of the situation.
Right.
There's nothing that's going on that the GM can't handle or expect, but, like, it seems to me that you're saying that the GM needs to take a step, like, lower the level of control. Like,
yeah, don't worry about so much. Like, if you've come up with, for a session, this grand plot and all these action scenes you want to get done, and of course what always happens, the players go off that track. Instead of going saying, guys, come on, this is what I created, let's do it, you're like, all right, you're going somewhere else, let's roll with it.
Yeah.
And you've got to be a good enough GM
and you don't just
to wing it,
tack, I mean, whatever you were planning to put them through to the west instead of to the north.
No, you can still do that. I mean, okay. that's
what I do in my games. All your standard, sure.
All your standard GM options are there.
Okay.
But again, if you want to really kind of have a satisfying experience of these people are playing in something I created and is reacting organically, then they don't save the maiden. Maiden gets killed, or Johnny the Lich takes it home to hell, what have you. They go off and want to go fishing.
I tell you what.
They go fishing. And then they have fish, so the famine hits and they're fine. So
I normally when I run a game, I'm kind of a 51-49 sort of GM, that I give my players 49% control of the game. I give them a lot of control and a lot of breadth that many GMs would be afraid to do. I do not railroad. That if in the first scene they kill my ultimate bad guy, he's dead. I won't take that away from them. But I've got to say that generally speaking, one of the real problems I have is having seen so many games destroyed by player and character issues, I am afraid to take that step of relinquishing just that bare majority of control of the game.
Oh, but
and
Dan,
just saying go wild.
It's like bucking off the shackles. You feel so free and so light after you've done that.
It's like Chocolat, the movie.
You know, I was going to see an action movie when Chocolat was out, and it was the only one they were going to let me in because it wasn't rated R. I was like 16.
You know, the only reason I saw Chocolat is because I was on a plane going from, it was either Dallas or Miami, I think it was Dallas, to Venezuela, and this is what they were playing on the seat in front of me.
I would just like to clarify that I did not, in fact, go see Chocolat. Once I got the offer, we went back to some dude's house and played Mega Man X.
It was after watching about half an hour of Chocolat that I learned that, in fact, you cannot open the external doors of an airplane mid-flight. So, but, you're saying, though, that once you take that dive, that...
You know, you can have, if your players aren't ready for it, it's not going to work. It requires a lot more cooperation, and it works well with a well-established group. If people know each other and know your tendencies, it's right. going to do well. But even I've seen it happen well with new groups also. It's just a matter of when the players realize that they're going to be better off cooperating in this. I mean, if somebody wants to plot against the other, this is the perfect kind of campaign for it, though, too. Because you have all these resources you can tap, and you're not worried about, okay, we have a balanced party, can we take the dungeon?
See, this is another issue I've had. I'm curious if you've ever seen this, if so, how you've dealt with it. The very few times that my campaigns, I have had a real, and I'm not talking some level of tension, because tension's just interesting.
Sure.
You know, where two guys don't quite get along. But what I've really had, guy X is plotting against guy Y, that one of them is really out to genuinely screw, kill, undermine, whatever the other, that this invariably spills over into hurt feelings and tensions between the players, not the characters, between the players.
Sure.
And it would scare me that in a player-driven game, that especially if the players do not have the same goals, or even worse, they have competing or conflicting goals, that have you seen this happen, or have your groups
I've
just
seen
been,
it happen. I mean, I've seen it happen successfully.
I think anybody who's played some games has seen that happen. You know, it always, there's hurt feelings when somebody doesn't get what they want in a role-playing game.
Somebody by game two of the new group decides that he can play as thief and pickpocket the wizard.
What I've seen,
then it goes.
The most success I've seen when this happens, which can easily happen in this, is when you take that and make sure the players know, look, don't get hurt feelings. Use this as the story. The conflict between you guys in this place, that's fantastic. Work with it. Make it a grand story, and we're going to have a great campaign.
Right.
Don't take hurt feelings. Remember that it's about the game. It's not all about your characters, but your characters are big. Have fun with them.
Right. So I guess in many ways that this is one of those things where this is just as much about the players as it is about the GM.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Make sure each individual feuder can handle it and handle it very, very well.
I know I've got to a point in my gaming where most players that I'm willing to sit down with are kind of past the point of all that petty stuff.
Yeah. Right.
There's not much time to game. We're going to have fun with it. Let's not worry about all this baggage and, oh, my character can kill your character and I'm threatening you. Let's just sit down, have fun. And, you know, if we have some inter-party conflict, let's make that fun instead of making it something that tears the group apart.
All right. Now, with that aside,
now we get to the real meat or, important topic.
Well, that wasn't the meat. What'd you guys invite me here for?
Oh, for this part. You've now GM'd two games for Phil.
Uh-huh.
Go.
Phil, Phil's got a bad rep. That train dirigible works amazing if you let him use it in the game. That's all I'm saying.
Did you let him have it?
What?
No,
of course.
They have an airship. They have an airship. That's But he's not tried anything completely unreasonable. He's done some cool high action stuff. He shot a lot of people.
And this sounds like Phil.
He did try to do the, I'll charge the army, pretty much, I'll invade this Duke's mansion by myself to end the plot quickly. But their bill shut it down. It was cool.
Just wait.
Well, I got to make sure he comes back. There's not been enough explosions yet.
He'll come back.
So we'll see.
What would you have done if he actually had invaded the Duke's mansion by himself? Would you have killed him?
I would have rolled with it if he would have ended up.
Yeah, that's another good question. Do you kill characters?
I do kill characters. Yeah, my
good. I do too.
I like to say let the dice fall where they may, but I don't. You know, I like
no one does that.
I like to give players a good chance, but if they, it's kind of what you guys discussed a few episodes ago. You know, if they've been informed they're doing something chancy, risky, or it's dramatically appropriate, I have no trouble with killing a character.
I call that the douchebag role.
That's a douchebag.
Yeah, I'm same way. I'm hesitant to kill characters simply because of my fear, and I've seen this happen. The faster you kill characters, the less people tend to invest into them. But having said that, yeah, I'll definitely do the douchebag roles, and I'll definitely do dramatic moments. But I'm very hesitant to kill characters just because I'm afraid that people start making them disposable because they know they're going to go away anyway.
Here's the neat thing that works with these kind of sandbox type games is that usually players have invested so much into it, and maybe they've built up an organization themselves, that even if the character dies, they've got something they can draw from that's still in the game, that's still theirs, and they can create, oh, well, my second in command takes over, I'm going to play him.
Right.
And you work him into the plot. And also, consequently, you have a lot more options. You know, the villains may not be trying to just kill the players in this. There's a lot of control aspects. You know, if you have somebody under your sway in the, you know, a small community, it becomes a lot more fun than if you have, you know, just kill them outright.
Are there some game systems or game settings you found that just don't work for this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's Vampire and most of the World of Darkness games work very well for this.
Yes.
Obviously, we've covered that.
Right.
And, but games like any game where you have to go out and adventure to get experience, you know, D&D being the main one, doesn't really work well, doesn't lend itself well to this.
Right.
And that covers actually a lot of the games out there.
Actually, the couple player-driven campaigns I'm aware of in D&D, and this is, you know, anecdote and all, but the couple few I'm aware of have always turned out tragically. Mm-hmm. Battletech's another one I'd say where it doesn't work because you have to work together.
Yeah.
You know, you're in mechs which don't transport themselves from planet to planet. You've got this kind of limited set of goals, limited set of resources. Assuming you're playing the game right, you have to work together. You can't be out wandering by yourself.
There are plenty of games out there that don't tie advancement into just my character gets better. They have ways to tie themselves into the setting by buying, you know, advantages or backgrounds or what have you. And those are the ones that really lend themselves well because that establishes, that ties somebody into the setting right off the bat beyond the story. I'm a big fan of games that allow you to take your backstory, take what you think is important to your character, and make it mechanically tie into things.
Can you give me examples of some systems that you think do that really well?
The biggest one is Fate 3.0 Spirit of the Century. Your aspects are basically you come up with these adjectives or quote that are your character. You know,
right.
Whether they be, you know, something about your past, something that you feel, and that it shows you right up front, this is what's important to my character. Burning Wheel is another really good one that has a lets you put out front, here's what I want in the game, here's what my character is about, and let you tie into whatever setting you like. Those are two that come to mind. The new game that I just picked up that I'm falling in love with quickly, it's called Rain by a guy named Greg Stolz. He's been in the industry a while. And it's the first game that lets you, that I've seen that without doing calculus, lets you take control of organizations, he calls companies, whether
like
it be
calculus.
Running a pirate ship or running
right.
a country or a church. It has rules for these that are easy and abstract, but still make the PCs the stars.
Right.
And I've been very impressed with it. And it's something I've always looked for, but never have been able to find something that, again, doesn't use calculus.
I've ran a couple ship campaigns, all right, but the floating autonomous state of the pirate church would be a pretty good one.
I agree. So there are lots of settings and systems out there that won't work. I mean, a lot of times you have to kind of homebrew this because, again, you have to internalize the setting. You have to know it. And you can read all about a setting all you want. If you don't invest yourself into it, you're not going to get the level of knowledge you need to run it.
So the current game that you were running that has Phil within it.
Yes.
Is that Savage Worlds?
I'm using Savage Worlds. I originally used Spirit of the Century, but I switched over to Savage Worlds to run my, I call it Renegade Horizon, which is kind of a hard to sum up game. It's a genre mash, which is one of my favorite things to do. It's Indiana Jones meets Final Fantasy meets Call of Cthulhu meets
what?
Cyberpunk, not Cyberpunk, but Steampunk. It's a little bit of everything, and it's a lot of fun. It meets a little bit of Serenity in there, too.
I kind of like that mashup, actually. That sounds kind of cool.
It's pulpy, magic, techie goodness.
Even with Serenity on there?
Well, I've never seen Serenity. You know, with Serenity slash Firefly, my beef, unlike Mike, I've actually never seen it. I just got so agitated by the hype that it's just like I was so tired of hearing about it that
watch.
I wanted to have nothing to do with it. It's my same beef I have with the iPhone currently.
Dan, get over yourself.
Yeah.
Watch Firefly.
Dan,
I will.
Wash is in Wedding Crashers.
Well, now. Watch it. Now,
and Dodgeball.
Knocked up.
Well,
that's what I meant.
Now that the hype is, now that the hype is over, now that I can stop signing my posts with me wears a brown shirt, I can now I can finally get down to maybe I'll borrow the DVD from somebody and watch Firefly.
I will bring it over for you.
And have an educated opinion other than I wish people would shut the hell up about it. Oh, so
right. Just don't go in with the high expectations. You're probably going to like it. I love it.
Right.
But ignore the hype. It's a good show in itself, but it right. probably doesn't live
yeah,
up to the hype.
Well, yeah, nothing can live up to the kind of hype it got.
Except for Harry Potter 7.
So
I am going to be in costume tomorrow night.
Hermione kills Dumbledore.
Oh my
so, God. All right. Thanks, you guys. Thank you, Luke, for coming by and
hey,
sitting in
pleasure.
With us.
It's been an honor.
It's been great Luke. Fun. And as for the rest of you guys, once again, don't forget to vote for us in the Ennies from all of your various IPs, or just get out there and vote in general. And we will catch you guys next time. This is you're leaving me blue balling here. Can't
ta-ta.
Somebody, thank you. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.